Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
We begin this hour with a corporate malfeasance roundup. It's been a particularly nasty week for misdeeds in the marketplace, as it turns out. In the last few days alone, we see J.P. Morgan brokers accusing the company of steering clients to bad investments. We see GlaxoSmithKline pleading guilty to defrauding patients who use its diabetes and antidepressant medications. And we see Barclays Bank paying a big fine for manipulating global interest rates to make more money for itself. And people say they don't trust the government to run things. Heidi Moore, New York Bureau Chief from Marketplace, is here to explain some of these revelations and put them into context. Hello, Heidi. Happy 5th of July.
Happy 5th of July. Good to be here.
And I know the Barclays scandal is getting the most buzz, but I want to start with GlaxoSmithKline because it's so personal for people. They pleaded guilty to fraud and agreed to pay a $3 billion fine, the largest ever involving a pharmaceutical company. What did they do?
Yeah, they did a lot. It's basically illegal marketing. I mean, in one case, they had, it seems like they arranged with Dr. Drew, who was kind of the famous TV psychiatrist, to promote things like Wellbutrin, right? And it looked like he was really suggesting that to people, but in fact, he was funded by Glaxo Wellcome, which is a predecessor of GlaxoSmithKline. And basically, that is what they did writ large along a whole bunch of other products. And it really highlighted how in the medical products industry, you know, we don't see a lot of objectivity there. We see a lot of healthcare companies funding studies that doctors do, and then the doctors recommend those drugs. And there are a lot of kickbacks, there's a lot of malfeasance. And I'll say that even though GlaxoSmithKline is paying the fine, this is being done by so many other companies in the healthcare space that you wouldn't even believe it.
And I want to get into what kind of penalty would actually dissuade them from doing it again, because a lot of people think even this $3 billion won't do it. But with respect to the particulars, Wellbutrin, which you named, according to one account I read, it was being marketed for conditions for which it was not approved by the FDA, such as weight loss and sexual dysfunction. Right? It was approved only to treat depression.
Right, exactly. The FDA is incredibly conservative about what it approves drugs for, but of course, I mean, just the way that chemistry works, things can have other applications. The problem is, can you market them that way? Because the FDA tests to make sure that Wellbutrin works for what it works for. But if you're trying to say that it works for sexual dysfunction or something else, where's the proof about that? And what do we know about the after effects? And that's what makes it dangerous. Of course, this is how a lot of really great drugs got their start, right? Like Viagra had other applications before it was known for what it's known for. So, but the problem is the healthcare companies get behind that because they see this gray market for profitability where the drugs have not been tested. And we've seen recently a lot of drugs not get FDA approvals, and that's because the FDA is incredibly strict. So we really just, the healthcare companies are trying to circumvent the rules by making their drugs look like they're miracle drugs, and they're not.
Right. And I guess you make a good point about these off-prescription uses. If people say, hey, this drug is really supposed to be for heart conditions, but it helps alleviate my anxiety, then, why not? But on the other hand, if it's not approved for that, patients need to be told. And another antidepressant in the GlaxoSmithKline case was Paxil. A warning was added to that drug that it could increase the risk of suicidal thoughts in teenagers. But originally, what was the problem?
Yeah, well, I think the thing with Paxil is that I'm having trouble recalling the actual problem with it, but it just wasn't serving what it was supposed to serve.
Right, and it was, I believe in that case they were withholding studies. The warning was not communicated to patients, especially minors, that this could be a side effect because they didn't want people to be reluctant to buy it. And then this goes to the problem, too, with the diabetes drug. Failing to report safety data about the diabetes drug Avandia. Now, people with diabetes probably know that as of 2010, this drug became severely restricted in its use and availability because of studies showing heart risks. But the case here is that Glaxo withheld those risks from the FDA. And I'm sorry, but how craven does a company have to be to not report heart risks from a widely used diabetes medication?
Right, exactly. Pretty craven, and for the sake of profitability. With Paxil, I mean, you're right. It was withholding studies. It's withholding information. It's this whole view that, you know, they put themselves in the position of not giving people the information that they really need. And we also remember this with Accutane, right? Back in the 90s, it led to the same thing, kind of suspicions of suicidal thoughts and things like that. And what happens here is that the companies really become greedy and full of hubris. You know, they figure people don't have the right to make their own decisions, and they're hoping that people will make decisions based on ignorance. I mean, a few years ago, what happened is that healthcare companies were allowed to market drugs directly to the public, right, in ads, in magazines, on TV, and so on, whereas before they could only market them to doctors. And so if you're marketing to the public, you know, you're not, they really don't want to arm the public with the full facts. And that's a very Wall Street point of view, right? Trust us, we're the experts, we'll make the decisions, and, you know, you just kind of sit there like sheep and take it. And it's really offensive on a basic level.
Which goes exactly to the J.P. Morgan story. Trust our brokers to recommend the right investments for you. But then it turns out that they're trying to advantage J.P. Morgan mutual funds over others, even when they knew that the J.P. Morgan funds weren't performing as well.
Right, exactly. And this was actually a widespread problem with Wall Street's industry. There was a rule called open architecture where every bank, if it had mutual funds, still had to recommend mutual funds from other banks and from other companies. And of course, open architecture was a failure because what would happen? All the advisors, whether they were at JP Morgan or at other banks, I mean, there were, I think, investigations at American Express even, they would recommend their own products because they got higher commissions internally when they recommended their own funds. So even though the law says one thing, what do the internal commissions and incentives say? They say sell our product to the exclusion of other people's health, to the exclusion of their own wisdom. And that's the tie between Glaxo and, you know, the J.P. Morgan situation.
Heidi Moore, New York Bureau Chief for Marketplace, as we talk about corporate malfeasance in the news, a particular collection of them, a concentration of them in this week's news. People are calling in about these cases. So, folks, for those of you who don't have us on our speed on your speed dial, it's 212-433-WNYC, and we'll get to some of you. 212-433-9692 to talk about these J.P. Morgan, Barclay, and GlaxoSmithKline instances of corporate malfeasance or alleged corporate malfeasance. I want to go back to the pharmaceutical case for a minute and just point out two things that I think are important. One is that the crimes were brought to light by internal whistleblowers. And two, though the company is paying the biggest fine ever against a pharmaceutical company, $3 billion, critics say it won't stop future toying with people's health unless actual people are held responsible, not the company as an entity. So why wouldn't individuals who made those decisions be put in jail rather than merely a monetary fine on the company as an entity?
Well, a lot of those people may have left, right? It's been through a lot of, Glaxo has been through a lot of mergers and acquisitions in the past decade. And what's also interesting is that not only was this brought to light by whistleblowers, but, you know, this is behavior going back to 1999, and we're just finding out about it now, which is another connection with Wall Street, you know, with interest rate fixing, with the J.P. Morgan funds, with all of that. All of this happened, you know, 5 to 10 to 12 to 16 years ago, and we are just now cottoning on because of government investigations. And, you know, as much as those whistleblowers tried to do, imagine the uphill battle they had to get their work recognized. Of course, while those internal investigations were going on, what was happening? People were resigning. The company was merging with other companies. There was new leadership in place. You know, they can always say that was the previous Glaxo. That's not us anymore. And I bet that's the argument that they made to regulators. But we know that corporate cultures remain remarkably consistent even through mergers and acquisitions. And what we have now is, because it takes so long to bring these companies to account, they can pretend that they don't still have the same wrong ways of setting incentives and the same, you know, corrupt ways of handing out commissions. But we know that they really do, because what are the chances that they change the way they do business just because somebody else is sitting in the manager's seat? It's very, very low.
Let's take a call from somebody who I think has maybe have some good input on this. Nadine in Westfield, you're on WNYC. Nadine, hi.
Hi, thank you, Brian. Thank you. My only comment is this. If we're talking about GlaxoSmithKline and corporate malfeasance, one of the problems is they've made so much money over the off of these drugs. We're talking about going back 5 years. They made $18 billion a year for 5 years. That's $90 billion. They're getting fined $3 billion. That's a slap on the wrist, and it's the cost of doing business. It doesn't change a thing, not a thing. The only way that this can happen will be if two things happen. First, they get fined a lot more money. And secondly, and this is the scary part, but it would make people much more responsible, that the CEO and the COO face prison time. And perhaps the people who have done some of these things. I think about the Barclays, the CEO of Barclays. I think he should face prison time. Even if he didn't know it, he should have known it. And that is incompetence. So thank you. I'll take any response offline.
Nadine,
thank you.
Thank you very much. You get into some tricky territory there, Heidi, with holding people criminally responsible who didn't necessarily know something. But if not the CEO or the COO, at least find out how high up the chain purposeful fraud, for example, was known about, or purposeful illegal manipulation of global interest rates in the Barclays case, who actually did know. And maybe if those people were held individually responsible, it would be more of a deterrent than any size fine. Did we lose Heidi? Oh, we lost Heidi.
No, I'm here.
Oh, there you are. I'm sorry. I just lost you from my board for a second. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah, no, I completely agree with you on that. The thing is, with these investigations, they go on for years quietly, and regulators tell us nothing about them until they're announced. And then they're announced, and you get, like, you know, a big fuss, like this Glaxo news is going to be news for exactly one day, and business goes back to normal because no one really looks at, you know, tracing, truly tracing and holding responsible the individuals who should have known, right? With the fine seems to be a nice little bow that you wrap around this. And what we need is follow-up, right, after the fine. You know, what personal responsibility do people have to take? Because that becomes a deterrent, right? When people feel their own livelihoods and their own profits and their own reputations are going to be at stake, not those of some faceless corporation, no matter how dedicated they are to it.
Does Glaxo make so much profit that it can just metabolize a $3 billion fine?
It really can. I mean, that is a tremendous fine, you know, and clearly it's supposed to send a message. But as Naomi just said, I mean, they make $90 billion off these things. And, you know, maybe we need to talk about a better way to set fines. Should they be a percentage of profits or in fact, all the profits like we do with SEC fraud cases? You know, fund managers who commit fraud have to disgorge the profits. They have to give back what they've earned. And if companies had to do that on a more regular basis, would that be a deterrent? I mean, it's really hard to find the correct deterrent, but right now we're not looking at all. You know, we just have this old system of, you know, pay the fine, go about your business. And partially it's because you don't want to kill a company, right? Companies employ thousands of people. They contribute to the economy in their own ways, and you don't want them to go out of business. But at the same time, you want them to run their business right, and clearly our current system of hoping that shareholders bring them to account is not working.
We'll finish up in a minute with Heidi Moore from Marketplace on the corporate malfeasance in the news this week. I want to get a little bit more into the J.P. Morgan story, which was reported by the New York Times, giving advice to mom-and-pop investors that steered them to not the best funds for them, according to some of their own former brokers. And a little bit more on this Barclays Bank. Apparently, Barclays is getting a lot of heat for this, but a lot of multinational banks were manipulating global interest rates. Well, what does that actually mean for us? So more to come, and then we'll get into the God particle. as I said before the news, how often do you see a big New York Times headline, the lead story in the Times, that actually had the headline, "Physicists find elusive particle seen as key to the universe"? So before the show ends today, we're going to explain the key to the universe. So now you have sufficient incentive to stay tuned. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Heidi Moore, New York Bureau Chief for Marketplace, as we talk about this concentration of corporate malfeasance stories in the news this week. So our corporate malfeasance roundup. I want to take a call on this pharmaceutical thing, especially with respect to the antidepressants, because I think this is important. Richard in Highland Park, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling in.
You're welcome. I'm a child psychiatrist in New Jersey, and I just wanted to correct some statements, if you don't mind.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, the FDA does not test products. The testing is always done by the manufacturers, and often a manufacturer will choose not to seek an approval because their product is near the end of its patent life. Seeking approval from the FDA can cost $500 million to $1 billion. So as a psychiatrist, we often are forced to use products, particularly antidepressants, that have not been approved for a specific population because the manufacturer did not seek that approval. That doesn't mean that the product is not effective or safe.
How do you know what the safety actually is if it hasn't been tested? How do you get confident enough as a practitioner to use drugs for off-label uses, especially as a child psychiatrist? I assume you are prescribing antidepressants and other things to minors. How do you get confident enough about the safety if they haven't been tested?
Well, if the product has been approved, for example, in adults, and it's effective and well-tolerated, and trying to help a child who is very depressed and perhaps suicidal, I start the medication and I go cautiously with the dose, and I advance the dose cautiously.
And on the warnings about Paxil, which was one of the things that, according to this guilty plea, they put on the label too late, you know, long after they knew that it might increase the risk of suicidal thoughts in teenagers. You were concerned about that too?
Yes. And the reason I am is because when these warnings from the FDA came out, there was a sharp reduction in families consenting for the adolescents to be placed on antidepressants. And the result was a significant increase in completed suicides for the following 2 or 3 years.
So not using the drug can increase the risk of suicide, but using the drug can also increase the risk of suicide. So it's a question of in which scenario the risk is bigger for the individual?
Well, no, that's not correct, because what reported in the literature is that there's an increase in suicidal thoughts, not completed suicide. And in my own practice, I've found that dealing with an adolescent with depression, very careful history has to be done, because if the depression is an aspect of a bipolar disorder and an antidepressant is started, the result can be catastrophic, because the antidepressant then becomes destabilizing and can cause increases in agitation and mood swings.
And so the distinction you're making is that the label that the FDA required, that the risk of Paxil is increased suicidal thoughts, that it's important to distinguish between suicidal thoughts and actual suicides.
Yes, and the FDA requires the warning on any medication approved for depression.
Mm-hmm. Richard, thank you very much for calling in. Those are all really important points. And Heidi, to finish up on the banking stories, the J.P. Morgan that we were talking about quotes brokers saying things like, "It said financial advisor on my business card, But that's not what J.P. Morgan let me be. I had to be a salesman. So, again, I assume this is not just J.P. Morgan. Isn't the standard advice these days to never use a financial advisor who can also sell you any investments? Always use independent advisors who don't have to resist conflicts of interest?
I don't know if that will make a difference, honestly, because if you resist any financial advisor who has a conflict of interest, you won't have a financial advisor. It's just the way the financial industry works. Even if somebody is not working for J.P. Morgan and selling J.P. Morgan funds, they could be working for an independent advisor and have some sort of, you know, agreement with another financial firm to sell them your funds, or they could have connections you don't even know.
But aren't there people out there who just charge you based on the size of your portfolio, whether they tell you to hold or buy or sell?
I just don't believe that there's such a thing as unconflicted advice. I mean, no matter what, they get a percentage of what you're investing, right? I mean, I just don't think that they can stand back and give you the best advice. You have to pick somebody who you trust as a person, and, you know, you just can't look at their corporate identity and know that they're going to be trustworthy. That's the key among all of these.
Is this another black eye for CEO Jamie Dimon, who the article said approved the practice? This comes after the multi-billion-dollar losses the company reported on hedge funds that were supposed to make the bank's assets safer and instead put them more at risk, as you've talked about on the show before. Will the J.P. Morgan Chase Board of Trustees care about this new scandal?
I think they should care. And there's another scandal kind of brewing that J.P. Morgan may have helped rig power prices, and they're being investigated for that as well. So, but it's not just J.P. Morgan, and I think we would be mistaken to believe that it's just one bank. Mm-hmm. It's only this bank that got caught. You have to look across the industry, and that's where we have to start making the changes as at the financial industry and the healthcare industry, because these are just the ones that hit the news. But how much more? They have moves we haven't even seen yet, you know, and we only find out from government investigations 5 or 10 years later.
I heard that Mr. Dimon showed up at his congressional hearing the other week where he was grilled about those losses wearing presidential cufflinks.
Yeah.
What does that signal exactly?
I think it's gall, but it also has a kind of implication of we're all in this together, doesn't it? Right? And that's exactly the implication that bothers people.
Cufflinks with the seal of the President of the United States. That was apparently a gift from the President. I don't know if whether it was Obama or Bush, but apparently from a president. And this may be beyond our beat, but to me, this whole roundup of corporate malfeasance plays back into the health reform debate. People don't want government telling us what benefits insurance policies have to cover. But if it doesn't, then they're going to lie, cheat, and steal their way to leaving us vulnerable when we actually get sick. That's an editorial. But look what major companies do until they get caught, as revealed by this week's news.
Right. We need checks and balances, and we don't have that in a lot of companies because we have the illusion that they're private, and they're really not. They serve a public purpose. And so leaving it to themselves to have, you know, to police themselves is absolutely ridiculous. And as we know, the regulators come in too late. They're outnumbered and understaffed.
New York Bureau Chief for the Public Radio Program Marketplace, Heidi Moore, thank you so much.
Thank you.